that was another big thing. I'm like, were you remorseful as a family, or just sad at the fact that the shortcomings of raising your child is now in your face and you don't know what to do with it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you think, like, even when he said on the phone right at the end that he was going to enter a guilty plea,
yeah,
I think the mom just went on and be like, oh, like, how are you doing or something? Or, like, they just went, oh, okay. And then you could see on their faces they were visibly upset and everything, but they never went, okay, so you're admitting that you did it.
Yeah.
That never once came up to it. But they did talk about it together, the parents, off the phone more. But what was interesting is more of the focus of, where did they fail?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's where they were, like, very head, like, focused on, was like, where did we go wrong?
Yeah, because you raised a daughter and she's fine, quote-unquotation, right? But that's the thing, right? And that's what I was like, did you actually address it, though? Because he did. He, at the end, was like, I'm going to plead guilty, because he came into terms with the fact that he did wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what hurts, and then I kind of fall back into my own experience in the Women's Center. Historically, the Women's Center, the main area, didn't include men into it. So all spaces were off limits.
Yeah.
Me coming into the coordinator, I opened it up to all genders. Why? Because it's really important for me to have conversations with anybody kind of coming in, right? And I've had, of the 3.5 years, some very interesting conversations with a lot of young men that come into my doors, wrong or right or whatever. But I'm, in my head, when I'm in these kind of roles, it's my job to take your view as is, and we have healthy dialogue about it. That's how education happens. That's how curiosity is built. That's how you deconstruct a lot of, like, biases that kind of exist between one another, right? And also, recognizing everyone has biases, problematic philosophies, are a little racist, a little transphobic, a little whatever it is, but you're aware enough to be in check with those, and you're constantly challenging it. That's the important part, right?
Yeah.
So when these young men come in, and some of them do, and they're the latter part of the problem that I'm trying to solve, a lot of them will be like, I didn't see that being a problem. And then I'll be like, okay, well, why didn't you see that as a problem, right? Like, run me through what your experience is and let's talk about it, right? And a lot of the times when we build that relationship, I'm like, a few of them I can think of in my head, and now they've long graduated, but, like, it became almost like a bi-weekly conversation with them, where one conversation, and it didn't always end well. We didn't always agree with it, but I asked a lot of challenging things in between that, because I'm challenging their conditioning, challenging their socialization, and challenging the notion of consequences, right? And I'm like, just because you did this thing, and now we're reaping the consequences of it, whether that be suspension, expulsion, or whatever, where does that leave you? What are you going to do? How does it sit with you? You're angry, sure, but that's not going to amount to long-term actionable items here. What are you going to do with this, right? And a lot of them were like, no one's ever asked me that. I'm like, well, why did you do what you did, right? Now you're behind on your timeline of XYZ and, like, what your friends are thinking or what your social circle is. And that matters to them a lot of the time. So I think it's like, again, what are the adults in your life that you can go to outside of your own immediate family that will keep you in check? And that's, I think, another thing where I, like, obviously you're not going to see their entire lives at, like, soccer games or in whatever, what the extracurriculars might look like. But maybe they weren't part of extracurriculars because there's one mom working full time. There's another one trying to survive. Seems like the main character's parents also worked a lot. The dad was in and out of the house, and he pushed sports on his son, where his son wasn't, like, a sporty guy, because we talked about that theme about him feeling like he disappointed his dad,
because
he didn't conform to a definition of success for him, right? Versus the parents figuring out the time and putting aside the time to figure out their hobbies. And then I often started drawing parallels into my own personal life of how I was socialized as a child. And, like, with, like, I'm the only girl out of 8 sides of, like, my mom's side and my dad's side. So I'm literally the only female. So I'm surrounded by boys.
That's interesting.
And I'm often given a lot of autonomy and credibility in my very, like, immigrant household. So I act as, like, the buffer, the family decision maker. We were put in sports. My parents put us in all of the things until we got to the age where we couldn't be in all the places at once. And they're like, pick three. Pick three and we'll do those three and see how that goes, right? They were very involved for parents who worked 3 jobs growing up all the way. I had my grandma live with me. We were very much in a multicultural neighborhood. So a lot of the houses that had my grandparents working full time, it was the grandparents and the kids that kind of, like, cross-pollinated households. we were disciplined in different languages. We were brought up in different ways. We were challenged in different households. So I feel like the lack of diversity in your socialization also is present as well, right? But then again, there's no perfect way to raise a little individual. He's 13, yeah. Right? And you're going to make mistakes because you're human. Like, mm-hmm. No one has a handbook on how to raise men, women, and non-conforming gender identities. Like,
no.
You figure yeah. that out, right?
Yeah.
So it was a beautifully, well, really scary, jarring thing to watch. And me be like, God, I'm so happy I don't have kids. I was like, jeez.
Yeah.
And so it's a daunting task, and I get that juggling your relationship, your own oneself, like as the mom who was a stay-at-home mom, like what that must have been for her and like all that stuff too. But I think, again, these are really easy ways to slip, and I think it was depicted beautifully and almost jarring to a point where it'll scare you, because now you'll think about like what all the other 13, 14-year-olds, because like we have like a little middle school, high school on campus here as well. So some of the kids come up on campus and there's a delinquent bunch of young gentlemen who go around wreaking havoc on teachers yeah. and students here. And I just think about it, I'm like, how are we addressing these 13, 14-year-olds?
Yeah.
And what needs are not being met for them to behave like the way they do, right?
Yeah. I think like that's become a topic of recent years of essentially back home of being like, a lot more of that age group, probably like 13, 14, 15, of particularly delinquent boys go around doing things, but nothing's really being done to tackle it.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, oh, it's just that generation's very rebellious now and just doesn't listen to authority figures. And I'm like, but do we know why? Do we know what's changed? Has anyone asked them why then? Why they want to do this? Or like, why there's... Because I think of when I was growing up and I always had... I don't know if it was probably to do with the way I was raised and things, but I always had a very strong fear of authority figures, which kept me in check in terms of, like, I didn't do anything illegal and things like that, because I was very much scared of the consequences. I didn't speak back to teachers because detention scared me as much as prison did.
Yeah, yeah.
So why is it that those, I'd say, like, methods are not scaring young people as much anymore, or like keeping them in check that way? What's changed? Why is that not as successful as maybe it once was?
I think at that time too, like, I mean, discipline isn't necessarily the only way to like explain consequences to a young adult. Like, kids are very smart, right? Like, they're like me working with in like young children, infants. Like, I was a lifeguard for my entire life. I was teaching swim lessons. I was in day camps. I work at a youth shelter. I worked at safe injection sites. I was raised to fear authority, but I was a delinquent child. Delinquent early 20-year-old. And I think it was a lot of like broken relationships with my own household, the dynamics between both my parents. A lot of upsetness of wanting or being forced to be raised as the parent versus just acting my age. So again, it takes time and place and people into consideration here. But like, I think honestly, like before discipline, just talking to your young ones or any young adult with consequences, like if you do this, this is what's going to happen. And it was ironic because my parents were very like out of pocket traditional Indian parents. But I remember we got to the age of like high school, and I remember this being a thing with my mom because she works in mental health illness. She was in the downtown east side. She kind of understands like XYZ. She got my dad to take me out for drinks when I was like 17. And my dad was like, I mean, now I understand it because we talk about it now, but he took me out and essentially we took some shots, right? And it was like a 2-hour hangout. We were like talking and eating or whatever. And my dad watched me with like every shot of like where my level of consciousness was, what like how I could communicate XYZ. And then at one point at the end, he goes, so 4 shots right now are like your cap. Like that's where you can have a good time, but you're still very much in control of your thinking and your cognition and body movement. Mm-hmm. And he goes, after 4 shots, I can see XYZ, right? And he goes, so when you go to parties and you drink, you know this is your fun limit, right? Mm-hmm. So you won't get sick or XYZ. And he goes, and if you feel like you've drank in more than that, I want you to call me or your mom. I didn't really understand the severity of like what that meant, but I remember like talking to my mom as like a young adult now, and she was just like, "Well, yeah, like did I want you drinking? No, but I knew it was gonna happen because you're 16, you're part of sports. It's the time, right?" In the same breath, they always booted for us. So booting in Canadian culture is like going to liquor stores and like buying alcohol for you and your friends. When I turned 19 to 23, I clubbed so much. And in Indian culture, you don't show your parents what kind of clubbing outfits you're doing. Like, you don't want to do that. But I grew up in the early 2000s where there's a lot of violence and missing brown women and indigenous women in that time. Mm-hmm. And I was one of like four brown girls in my elementary, middle school. And high school was a little bit bigger, but like very white community. So my parents did everything they could to like kind of just make sure that I felt like if I made a really big mistake, I could come to them. So from 19 to 23, my parents would be like, you're going to go out, tell me where. They would see the outfit that I'm wearing. So if I were to be gone missing, they knew exactly what I'd look like.
Yeah.
And then they would be like, tell me a time. Any time you want me to come pick you up, wherever you are. Mm-hmm. So I went downtown. I went to Langley. I went to Abbotsford. But I'd always tell them one time. I'd be like, you cannot negotiate another extension of the time. This is the time I'm picking you up. And I knew because both my parents were working both like double time, right? So 3 a.m., 4 a.m., my mom and my dad would be there with McDonald's, with a change of clothes for all of us. And they dropped every single one of my friends off. And then they would come home. And wow, that is what they did for like the last like 3 years. And I got tired of clubbing. My mom knew. Like, she's like, if we just let her do it, she'll not want to do it forever. And then at 23, it did. Like, I was like, okay, I'm done. Like, I did my weekends. I had my fun. I don't want to do this anymore. And they were like, okay, cool, right? Mm-hmm. Which was quite progressive for they were not like that with other things, but that was the one thing where they're like, I don't want to not know what my daughter looks like. Mm-hmm. And my dad also, like, he would call me once in the whole time and be like, are you safe? Are there any men around? Like, how are you feeling? Just let me know if you want me to come pick you up or if, like, you want me to send over a friend or, like, a cousin to, like, grab you, right? Mm-hmm. And that was what we did for a while. And that really helped. And I didn't feel, like, this sense of shame of, like, what I was looking in front of my parents, regardless of, like, because they didn't care about what I looked like clothes-wise. They're like, do what you need to do. This is your age. This is the hottest you're going to be in this current time and frame. Yeah. Every day you're young. This is the time for you to dress the way you want to dress in that way, right?
Yeah.
So it was interesting kind of seeing that. And same with my brother. But weed came into play with my younger brother because, like, weed culture became quite prevalent, and as it is across Canada. But my parents were like, come home. Do it at home. Do it in the back deck. We're not going to, like, say anything to you. Some of his house parties also. He didn't go to a lot of house parties, but we had a lot of house parties. So my parents would leave, and I would chaperone with my friends. And that was the way we did it for him for a lot of the times, too. It wasn't perfect, I'm sure. But his friends were, like, from babyhood, like, from 5, 6. So they grew up, and I was very much integrated into their circle. And then eventually when they became 16 and 17 and they would say some things, my brother would be like, that sounds weird. Let's go ask my sister what that means. So consent conversations, conversations around sex, the conversations around, like, interacting with the opposite gender. I was kind of like their doorway into those conversations. So they all had siblings that were brothers, right?
Yeah.
So they're like, oh, that sounds like I'm only getting one perspective. My younger brother was like, let's get someone else's perspective. And then it'd be like me and a bunch of my friends kind of just like TED Talksing a bunch of like 16-year-olds and be like, yeah, so like, what does consent look like? You know, like, consent is like ever going in a situation. So when someone says stop, or if their body like feels like they're not enjoying it, maybe stop, ask, you know, like, so that era, I don't know if that's common amongst people now and how involved, but my younger brother was a very big part of my social culture. And all his friends were very much in my social culture. Like, we went out to parties and house parties and things like that. Like, he's a very big part of my life. So I feel like because of that, he was able to kind of, like, troubleshoot and, like, wall a lot of the thoughts and experiences and things that he was going through. Because he was in, like, basketball and football, and, like, the machismo was huge and very big on that. But he would always come back to me and be like, hey, I heard this. It makes me kind of feel a little weird. What does that mean? Or like, hey, you looked uncomfortable when I was taking part in XYZ. Why were you like that? Like, he was very in the know of, like, where my energy kind of shifted within our dynamic, which made it a lot easier for me to, like, socialize with his friends because they were all kind of like that as well. Wholesome little sweet folks.
Yeah, that's actually, I find very, I think it's wonderful that he was not only just acknowledging that there was a switch, but also questioning why and wanting to know why, and to potentially either change what he was doing or educate his friends and stuff like that. Because I don't know really many people that have that kind of relationship with their siblings that are brothers or sisters or whatever. Because I have an older brother. I don't think I've ever spoken to him about really much to do with this kind of area.
Yeah.
Same with my parents as well. I felt like it was very taboo still.
Yeah.
Based on how they were socialized and raised when they were kids, it was still a very taboo subject.
Yeah.
Like anything to do with sex and consent, all of that I got from school.
Yeah.
Which we all know sex ed has its pitfalls.
Yeah.
But also I got it from like talking with my friends, and it became the fact that I went into studying sociology at age 16 that I properly started to look more into like gender inequality and like sexual harassment. And now I do a sociology and criminology degree, so I look a lot into kind of sexual assault and rape cases and the trial system and things like that, that I probably have, I would say, educated myself more than like
other people.
Getting involved with other people, and it's like going to my lecturers and talking to them about things like that, and then talking about my friends. The radio has been a great help as well. I've met such a cross-section
of people
to talk about experiences with, not only just because it's a radio, but it's also a radio on the other side of the world from where I'm from.
That's
kind of how I've engaged in it. And I find it interesting because this Adolescence as a Show kind of does heavily focus, obviously, on the 13-year-old boy and how he got involved in the Manosphere kind of forums and the impact the Manosphere has. And there is a lot of talk of the impact the Manosphere is having on young boys and their actions and their beliefs and their attitudes. But I was wondering if you've had any, obviously you're part of the Women's Center, and even though it is open to all folks, that it, I assume you probably have predominantly more female people coming in, or like gender expansive people, or I could be very wrong there.
I think it's very interesting because it changes from semester to semester. I think it's just like the energy that I attract, but I actually, there was one semester where I would argue there was more men than women.
Interesting.
And there was way more men, like young men, who booked appointments with me and wanted to have conversations. So there's like one semester where I'd probably see like at least 4 or 5 young men, and maybe not as much as the female students are there, because my center acts as like a lounge and study area too. But I'd say like it really depends on the wave. And when men saw other men come in, they were more inclined to be curious. I think a lot of them, like, wait at the doorstep and kind of, like, look around and be like, I'm not allowed in the space. And I'm like, yo, dude, like, you're more than welcome. I'm like, please come in. This is a space for you as much as it is space for me, kind of thing. And then if some of their friends just kind of like, oh, so there's a bunk bed here, I want to go nap. And then they'll be like, oh, this is quite nice. So I can get a coffee and a tea. And then they'll kind of slowly start hanging out. And then they'll, like, integrate into the study programs. It's very funny to see how that all kind of pans out. And then all of a sudden my, like, table will just be surrounded by 6 or 7 different chairs. And it's just all of them kind of, we'll talk about music, we'll talk about whatever, and then they'll find out how old I am, they'll find out that I'm married, they'll be like, oh my god, what, I thought you were a student. And I'm like, you flatter me. But like, it's that building, it's that curiosity, like I let them be as curious as they can be. Sometimes they'll pick up safer sex supplies and be like, what is this? And I'll be like, well, what do you think this is? Like, looking off of whatever, you're a grown-ass man, like, tell me what you decipher from this. And then it'll sideway into a conversation about something else, because that's just kind of like the nature of the conversation. Or they'll be like, oh yeah, I saw you at the gym, like you were talking to one of my friends, and like, oh, like, you know, like, what do you do, kind of thing. And then there's a lot of the curiosity about my job and why I do my job. And then I think it's just kind of like, once they build that familiarity and the door is open, then I get like, we'll talk about like, I don't know, science for a while, or like sports. And then all of a sudden they'll be like, you know what, sometimes like I think like I'm not supposed to like be here, kind of thing. And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting thing to say, like, why would you say that, right? And I find that a lot of them just don't have like people to talk to, or like walk them through their emotions to figure out the words to say things the way they want to say. And I think it's quite beautiful. But I vividly remember last summer when there was like maybe 6 or 7 random young men, and then they ended up like kind of finding it, like looking at books, and then they were like really into these puzzles I had, so very playful. And then we had like a Nintendo Switch game time, and then obviously they wanted to be a part of that, so like, you know, more than welcome too. And then they just found really silly reasons to be in the Women's Center, until I was like, you can just be here, it's fine. And they're
that
like,
doesn't have to be a reason.
But I think they're conditioned to think that way.
And then
they'll be like, oh, okay, like, do you have time to like hang out? And I'm like, yeah, okay, sure, give me like a little bit to move some work around. But it was interesting, because then that's when the interesting conversations happened about their relationships and like how they feel like they should or shouldn't be. And then a lot of them walk away being like, I never thought I would have this conversation, actually. Like, you're kind of like my walking, talking journal, basically. And I'm like, okay, cool. Yeah. Well, you know, and they're like, it's hard to trust people because they're not conditioned to, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of stigma, right? And I think that's like the beautiful thing. Like, it's just, again, finding those community spaces that are not your parents or your siblings or your friends. And then you kind of finding and rediscovering yourself in safe spaces that you feel like you're welcome to kind of like say X, Y, Z in, right? That's the whole reason the Women's Center exists. That's the reason why On Campus exists. That's why we have SOCA. That's why I have DNA. It's different identities kind of coming in together, and then by association we have friends and allies, and they come and come in. And I tell these young men too, I'm like, no one's born perfect. No one's born to not make mistakes. You're gonna make a big mistake or a small mistake or a mid mistake, but a mistake is a mistake. It's how you critically analyze and you figure out a plan for yourself, and like, what kind of version are you trying to work towards, right? And that made me sad. And a lot of them, honestly, until graduation time, or like when I really like hit strings with them, is like, can I get a hug? Like, I remember one guy just being like, I had a really bad day, can I just have a hug? I'm like, yeah, dude, you get a hug.
Yeah.
He's like, you give good hugs. I've seen you give hugs to people. I want a hug. I'm like, okay, sure. And he's just like, no one other than my mom has ever hugged me, and she doesn't hug me a whole lot, right? So it's like small things like that, you know. And I see it with young students, like little kids that walk around, like that have the attention and access to comfort physically versus don't, and just like their demeanor changing in X, Y, Z, right? You can see it in summer camps and swimming camps and whatever, how a kid is when they make a mistake and how they react, and how excited or not excited they are to talk to their parental figures about that mistake. And that small, simple thing means so much as they get older, right?
Yeah.
So interesting.
I think, yeah, the power of a hug. The power of, like, just some form of physical intimacy in that.
Sometimes you just need a hug, and it's not weird, you know? Like, I think that's the cultural part of it, too. Oddly enough, I think Western culture have taken on some very traditional non-Western ideas of physical intimacy and intimacy in, like, companionship. It doesn't have to be a romantic partner. That's the whole reason why we have friends. That's why we have different community centers. That's why we have counselors and therapists and women's center coordinators out there trying to do what they can. Because, like, at the end of the day, that's our job, is to listen. To be there, to offer you comfort, to teach you and guide you, and like not to judge you if you don't listen to advice. Because that's another thing. Just because you tell people things, certain things or a pathway, doesn't mean that they need to take that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your word is not law, right? They're autonomous to decide for themselves. You just have to be like, these are your options. You can pick what you want and see how that works for you. Or you can go through each of them and see what that means for you, right?
Yeah.
But accepting that person, knowing that you've spent all this time and energy trying to educate them, doesn't always mean that it's going to work out for the better.
Yeah.
Right?
No, exactly.
So
I think, like, one thing I was a bit interested to ask you of, because I do feel like there is a heavy focus, which is understandable, on the Manosphere's impact on young boys and young men, because obviously the content that is created by the Manosphere is predominantly directed towards them.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, have you encountered any students that are female that have encountered the content and spoken about how they felt about it? Or
Yeah.
Because I think I hear more about the consequences of Manosphere's influence on men. That is, the consequence is what happens to a young girl. A lot of the time, I feel like that's the focus in headlines.
Yeah.
But I wondered, I don't know much of young girls and like my friends who have actually encountered it online and how it's made them feel. I've not spoken to a lot of people about that.
I think a lot of it's like disassociating. I think it's hard for young women to process like the feelings attached to it necessarily, especially if you're like so young and you don't necessarily have like the right verbiage to communicate the awkwardness of it. Because I think women are often conditioned to be competitive with one another. And I think from like a young age, from like our, so it's like you have to present yourself for the male gaze. Although I do feel like there's like a shift of like the baddie culture, like a lot of the women, and I think it's beautiful. Like, you know, you're dressing up for the girls, you're hanging out with the girls. There's that conversation of like queer and gay culture, so you're seeing like a rise in more autonomous decision making when it comes to fits and XYZ. As far as in the center goes, you know, it's interesting because like a lot of them that are in relationships where low key kind of gives me Andrew Tate vibes. It's like intimate partner balance. You can't call it right away, right?
Yeah.
You have to open that window and build that relationship for them to come back to you and to kind of like explain things a little bit more contextually. I think a lot of the women are like taught to be really empathetic, and they to reason and something happened, and then they find the reason as to why it could happen. Like, maybe he was stressed. Mm. Maybe he's really tired. Maybe a lot of things are happening at like a family stuff. You know, like he's a nice guy. Like he means well, right?
Yeah.
But then like, but there's always that but, right? And I'm always like, but you feel a certain way. So let's talk about that but. Like you don't have to do anything about it, but like you're hesitant, right? It's making you think, and you've come back to this one topic or situation that's happened in the past quite a bit. So let's explore that, right? I find that if you call it too quickly, too soon, and you label it bad, it, like, they stonewall you.
Mm.
So a lot of them don't know how to name it and need to be walked through naming it, or a lot of them don't want to acknowledge it, or a good chunk of them that do, which they're there, are like, you know, like, I blame the socializing of men, and now I have to wait for them to kind of grow up to, like, level out that field, you know?
I've heard about that a lot of, like, yeah. waiting for a guy to grow up out of this, like, mentality yeah. and things, yeah.
Yeah, then there's, but then also, like, culturally, if you, like, take a macro level to all of this, I mean, women have education more than men. We're striving to get equal pay.
Yeah.
You know, we can own our own credit cards, we can own our own land, we can get our own houses. So the traditional benefit of being in a partnership with a cis man, what is there now, right?
Mm.
Like, what are we building towards? Because if we don't need him for a house, if we don't need him to provide XYZ, women aren't having children at the same rate, they're having them a lot later. The acceptance of queer culture, so like, yo, you could just, you know, explore your sexuality and see how that goes. But if you so choose to settle or to be romantic with a cis man, then it's like, what are you really in it for now, right? Like, you want him to be emotionally aware, in therapy, better boundaries with his family, with himself and his friends, and be a critical thinker. But then you got to ask yourself, like, are men taught to be critical thinkers at a young age outside of academia, outside of engineering and doctors and all those? Because that doesn't equate to being critical thinkers in your social culture and your interactions with people. People minimize how hard it is for you to be like a cognitively well-rounded individual to read people's emotions without a woman deciphering it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
You can't read a crowd or people in interactions and walk away and be like, oh, that was a really uncomfortable situation, and then you and your partner talk about it, versus your partner walking you through it, and then you're led into that decision inevitably, right? And even with the show, I will not walk men through my thought process on that show. Because I'm like, you watched the same show I did.
Yeah.
You probably had moments. Let's talk about that. Because I'm not going to tell you my opinion until you tell me your opinion beyond two sentences. Right? Mm. But, like, they're not taught to express their emotions in that same way. So, like, how do you expect someone to communicate with you if that's not something that could do it? And I think communication and these, like, manosphere conversations of, like, guys with, like, a microphone explaining, like, oh, they're woke and the, like, XYZ or, like, the true meaning of a woman. And that is on the rise.
Yeah.
That might feel off to you, but if your guys aren't questioning it either, like your group of friends, then you're not. Then you're complacent. Complacency and apathetic responses are part of the problem, right? Because a lot of them, like, I don't have an opinion about this. I'm like, but you should have an opinion about this, right?
I've had a lot of like, well, I don't know enough about it to have an opinion, which is, I'm kind of a bit like, well, you could still have an opinion on the amount that you've seen and read, but then it's like, oh, I don't know enough about it, but then they don't make a conscious effort to then know enough to potentially form a more well-educated opinion or something, and things like that. I am just looking that we are about a minute away from the next show. I have loved this conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come down here and speak about it. I think this has been so insightful to me. Because I feel like I haven't discussed this properly with someone that's not my mother, to be honest. I just had this, me and my mom talk about this just a lot because she was like, it's a great Netflix show, watch it.
Yeah.
And then just talking about it, which is great, but I also am like, I have an older brother. Yeah. Have you spoken to him about it?
Yeah.
And things like that.
Why me? Versus
exactly. And I don't know if it's because I'm halfway across the world and limited conversation times, but we shall find out when I go home. And I'll be like, let's start this conversation with everyone present and things like that. But stay tuned for Democracy Now that is coming up, and I'll see you again right here next week. Thank you again for joining.
Thank you.